I don't ever want to design or influence an experience to have it be just what I would want to do.
Welcome to the User Defenders Podcast, where we interview successful UX designers who fight for the user in order to inspire and equip you to do the same. And now, here's your host, Jason Ogle.
Greetings, User Defenders. Welcome to episode 17. Today, I had the privilege of interviewing UX researcher and author Victor Yako. Victor is the first PhD super guest to grace the show. His superhero name couldn't be more appropriate, and I won't spoil it for you. You'll have to listen through to catch it. This was such a fun one. So much goodness ahead, so I won't delay any further. Here's my interview with Victor Yako. Victor Yako is an author and has just completed his upcoming Manning Publications release called Design for the Mind, Seven Psychological Principles of Persuasive Design. He's an active speaker who's been invited to speak at notable UX conferences such as IXPA and IA Summit. He's a prolific blogger who's published articles on Smashing Magazine and A List Apart. His interest and expertise include the application of psychological theory to digital design, user research, innovation, and reducing the abuse of alcohol in design and tech. He's also a husband and father and has engaged in gorilla research while standing in front of gorillas. Now, I love that, Victor. I'd love to hear more, but I'm super excited to have you on the show today.
Hey, Jason. Thanks. I'm happy to be here, and I'm really glad you threw that line in now.
How could I not? That's so great.
Oh, well, I appreciate that. And I would love to explain how that happened. And there's actually going to be an article in an upcoming Smashing post. Ooh. that covers that. So
perfect.
We can give a sneak preview of that and spoil the surprise.
Awesome.
And I also wanted to say to you, thank you very much for having me on the show today. I'm also a fan, so that's cool. I've appreciated the content that you've covered in all of your episodes, and I can see the buzz about the show growing online and all the positive reviews so far. So it sounds like you've got a great thing going here, and you're definitely meeting a need that the UX community has. And then also on a personal note, I wanted to say congratulations, and I understand you're expecting another bundle of joy to add to your family based on at least what I've heard from your year in review episode, and that sounds like it's happening any day now.
Yeah, well, thank you, Victor. That means a lot to me, man. Our child is due. It's a girl, and she is due February 18th of 2016. And I believe, what is it? It's the 26th of January as we record this. So just a few weeks here. So it's go time. Let's jump in here with our show. And as you know, it's we take a fun superhero approach here to this. It's yeah. It's an homage to my comic nerdiness from the days of old, but it's also sort of a fun differentiator for this show. So I want to start out with the first segment, which is your secret identity and origin story. Now, every superhero has one. Let's talk about yours, Victor. I'd like to start the show by you taking a few moments to give us a look into your personal life.
Well, like I told you, I am a father of three and a husband. So a lot of what I do is related to family and, you know, raising children, as well as trying to help out my wife with all of our other adult responsibilities. Mm-hmm. I like to run. I'm not a fast runner, so I sort of plod along. But I guess as far as mortals go, my ability to keep running is fairly strong. And I've run a few marathons in my life. I'm not sure that I'll be able to do that again just because of the amount of time it takes to train. But so I've run, I think, four marathons and a number of half marathons. And it's always something that I do. It's a great stress relief, and you know, it's something that also has the fringe benefit of being healthy and allowing me to eat a little bit more than I normally would. And then other than that, I love to write. Like you said, I have quite a few posts out there and industry publications and blogs, and it's something that is always sort of working its way into my life. And I never thought I'd really be at a point where I'm writing about what I do. You know, I always thought maybe I'd write more about fiction or something, I guess you would say, a little more exciting. But this is actually what's exciting to me, and it's what makes sense to write about. So it comes then from me as advice to other people who ask about writing is always write about what you know. And even if what you know is being a student, being a first-year employee, that there's always some audience out there for your content, especially if you have a message where you're trying to just sort of share and present lessons learned. So, you know, that's something that takes up most of my free time as well as writing.
Absolutely. And I love your writing, Victor. I've read your articles, the ones that you pointed me to. I know you have a lot out there, but I've read those articles, and I love your sharing your experience, your expertise in this area, especially as it relates to the mind. I think as designers, that's sort of one of our sort of obstacles in our process quite often, and it should really be the initial part of this, is what are people thinking? What are they wanting? What are their pain points? So I love that you share that, and you have your own voice. You have your own unique, again, perspective and expertise, and that really comes through in your articles that I'll be sure to share in the show notes.
Great. I'm glad you feel that way. And, you know, that's my hope, and I also think that's probably why I've gotten so many additional opportunities to write. And for me, it's something that the translation of academic knowledge or research and theory to application is lost in many, many fields. It's not a design thing. It's you know, I've worked for my background, and part of how I was able to do gorilla research in front of gorillas is I did a lot of work in environmental education, environmental science. And when I was in a past life as a researcher, I would do a lot of work with visitors to zoos, and I would intercept visitors while they were observing the gorilla exhibit or observing the manatee exhibit. And I would try to get insight into what types of information they were learning from their visits. But a lot of the exhibits in zoos are informed by academic research, but somebody has to be there to translate that research, because when somebody who is just very involved on a day-to-day basis with writing about theory, writing about research methods, and publishing articles that they want to present at super academic conferences. And, you know, I've been in that situation, and I feel like the prevailing attitude is, well, we don't necessarily write for what would be considered the lay reader. It's we write for this academic audience. Well, there's so much lost. The value of the research in my mind and that value of the theory is in the application. And so my goal in everything that I write is, how does this come across as being something valuable to a practitioner? If a practitioner can't read my article and have takeaways, then I've done a disservice, because I've just sort of talked over people's head about a concept that I find interesting, which is fine, but it's also not something that I should be putting out then on a practitioner-focused publication like Smashing or UX Booth.
Yeah. And you do a great job of that, Victor. I know there's a lot going on in your head, and a lot you could easily go over all of our heads with. But I think you do a great job of bringing it down to a language and a format that we can all relate to and understand. So I appreciate that. Victor, could you tell us your origin story? I'd love to know what inspired you to pursue a career in this exciting, challenging, and ever-evolving field.
Sure. I will do my best to do that. Like many superheroes in this field, I think it was sort of fate and destiny that came together to bring me here. Because honestly, if you would have approached me 3 years ago and said UX, I would have said who? And probably just kept walking, because I had no idea what user experience was. I had no idea what digital design really was. So in my background was more in psychology and communication, but focusing on environmental issues and places that we call informal science education. So places like zoos, nature centers, natural history museums, and really looking at their visitors and how they learn, how they receive information, how all of these science experiences, and even places like art museums. I actually worked in an art museum for a while doing visitor research, but they all have goals, whether as a visitor you realize it or not. The zoo doesn't just want you to come and visit and have a nice time with your family. They want you to leave thinking, wow, I had an experience with the elephants, and I understand now that they are endangered species, and it makes me want to behave in a certain way or learn more about elephants or spread the word. They really have these action-oriented outcomes, but they're very hard to achieve. And so that's where research can come in and attempt to evaluate the current message and how it's working, but then also look at, well, what are some ways learning theory can help inform exhibit design or classroom instruction in some of these settings that have like naturalists or environmental educators. So I was busy doing that kind of stuff. And I actually, I was in Columbus, Ohio, which is the Midwest. For those of you geographically challenged, like some that I know, it's Midwest United States and often called flyover country, I think. But I took a different job actually than doing research and evaluation on criminal justice programming for the state of Ohio. And the whole reason for that was just I wanted a change, and I was still living and working in Columbus. And I went to school at The Ohio State University and got all my degrees from there. So go Buckeyes.
All right.
But as I was doing the criminal justice stuff, I really wasn't satisfied, and I knew that I wanted a change of scenery, and actually started putting some feelers out to a colleague, a former colleague in particular, asking her. She had started her own consultancy, if she knew of anybody who, including herself, was interested in doing some – allowing some freelance work to be done for them, because I wanted to start to experience broader horizons and see where this might take me. And she said, well, no, but there's a company that I've been working for, and they have a real need for like a full-time researcher, and I'm not willing to make that commitment at this time to leave my business and go work for them. So she hooked me up with, at that time, it was called Intuitive Company, and the rest really is history. I mean, what I realized within weeks was I have no idea what design terminology means. So things like UX and UI and wireframes, that was my level of – that was all over my head when I first started. But what I did know was I knew how to be a researcher, and I knew how to be a really damn good researcher, for lack of a better word, that I knew how to talk to people. I knew how to develop and design surveys and interviews. I knew how to observe people. I observed the heck out of people while I was standing around in the zoos, because we wanted to know – how are people engaging with these exhibits? And so the translation of research, psychological, educational research, from one setting to another was super easy. And that's really where my strong point was. And after I got comfortable with the language, well, then also Intuitive Company was a design firm, more of a consultancy-based. So I had to start getting comfortable with the terminology of the different industries I was working in. So it went away from zoo and science center talk to bank talk and university talk and financial service providers and pharmaceuticals talk. So I was in my element, because I was being forced to learn so much. And then at the same time, I realized I had so much to offer this field, because just like with the zoos and the aquariums, there was a need for practitioners to have basically user-friendly material to inform their designs. So I had already learned how to do that in working with educators and scientists and naturalists in these other settings. So I started to write, and actually started to do some internal presentations at work, and I realized that I had a really knack for communicating the message, and I started to draft proposals to the different blogs and publications, and to my surprise, they were accepted, and it became very much like, you know, this cycle of writing, publishing, writing something new. So I hope that covers the journey, but it was very much UX and design was never on my radar. But when I got here, I decided, you know, this is my space. I'm so comfortable here. I'm so happy to be here. And I'm comfortable in a way that, like, I enjoy functioning. I'm never comfortable. I'm always a little bit irritated that I need to keep on working and making sure that I'm staying my best. I can't be complacent. I do know that.
Yeah. And I think that if we did get comfortable in our work, I think that means we stop learning. And I know that what you do, especially in the research field, is all about that, being driven by that. And one of my takeaways from your origin story about working in the zoo, particularly, is it's neat to think well beyond the screen, well beyond the user interface. When we think about user experience, how a person, a user, is a human being, how they experience what we've created for them, whether it be on a screen or whether it be at the zoo. So I love that you shared that. And it really just, I think, opens up our horizons a lot more to think about UX in a much broader picture. And I also think that we need a new category, ZooX. So, hashtag.
I love it.
ZooX.
Perfect.
You heard it here first.
All the credit for that.
Thank you.
User defenders, Jason Ogle.
Yes.
ZooX.
ZooX.
I love it. And if it's not being used, it needs to be. Somebody needs to run with that.
Somebody trend that. Okay. So, who has been the biggest inspiration in your work and why?
That's a great question, and probably one that I don't have a super specific answer for. I would honestly say it's the people I work with every day that inspire me, and it has been that way for the last 2.5-3 years that I've been doing UX-related things. It's like really the designers, the developers, the project managers, engagement leads, everybody who's out there that I work with really wants to make a difference, both with the clients that we work with and then also with the actual product. We team up with people in a way that says we respect you, we respect your process, and we want to make it better. We want to take this where you want to take it, and we also want to make it usable and useful for the end user, and that we insert ourselves as the advocate for the end user. You know, that's why research is a part of everything that we do. But really, it's like I come to work and the people that surround me on a daily basis are, you know, my design team that I work with and give recommendations to. They inspire me. They make me realize, like, I can't take a half day of effort because they're always giving their fullest effort. I look at some of my designers that I work with on a daily basis. They love it when they're challenged. They love a tough problem. And it's like, I need to be like that. I need to make sure I'm like that, because it's admirable for somebody to not say, well, you know, it's two different fields, but I designed a homepage, or I designed a dashboard page for a life insurance company a couple months ago. And I really think that I could just rebrand that and it would totally work with this dental insurance provider or something like that. And it's like, no, instead, I see my designers take on each new challenge as a new challenge. They incorporate the things, the lessons learned. They definitely don't forget about the past, but they don't just call it in and say, well, we've done something similar and I can just slightly rebrand it or modify it. And so I really admire, and I think it's a creative trait. Like, people who are creatives in our field, they're all you guys. I'm including you in this because I know that you're one of the designers who I admire. That
thank you.
The thing about designers and developers is how creative they think, and this is their art. And so, while it might be something that somebody sees on their screen, or a million people see on their screen as just their dashboard or just how they make a phone payment, it's the result of a lot of thinking, a lot of passion, a lot of code that in the end, we hear many people say that, you know, the best design goes unnoticed. And yeah, maybe that's true. I'm not sure that I think that's true, but the fact is the best design has had somebody's heart and soul poured into it. And I can see that from my perspective where I stand, and it is admirable on a daily basis.
Well, that's such a great answer, Victor. To me, it says a lot about the people you work with. And I think a really big takeaway for all of us, for us in Defenders looking for a great place to work, that's sort of the standard, I think, that we should all have, is getting on a team like that. So I think that's a great answer, that your team inspires you every day and that you guys are making great work together. So
cool. I have to say that, like, those questions have always been the ones that have tripped me up the most over the years. I can remember in middle school being asked, like, who inspires me the most, and it always ended up being my mom.
Sure.
She does inspire me, but she's also the easy answer.
Yeah, well, that's great, man. If you weren't doing this for a living, Victor, what would be your second career choice and why?
Well, I think that I would probably write professionally if I could, and I really enjoy it. I think it's sort of an addiction, but in a positive way. It's something that the more I do, the more I want to do it. And part of it is just, it allows me to learn so much about myself. Some of the things, like, I write, I understand the theory, but I'm not necessarily sure when I start out writing what the application is. And it's as I write and as I process how I might see that theory play out in real life that I realize, oh, okay, so this is what this means to me, because this is where I took the article. And to be able to do that even more, or about even more things in my life, would be great. Now, I think that I'd have to accept a different quality of life if I was going to live on the pay of what my writing would make. But that's a different story. Mm-hmm. We're not all making J.K. Rowling or Stephen King money. And mm-hmm. I think the life of a full-time author is similar to the life of any full-time artist that is having to be out there not only creating their work, but then promoting it and getting it put in places where people are going to not only see it, but want to own it and pay money for it. And that's a tough life to choose.
Definitely. I love writing myself. It's funny, I knew that about myself because I've written for quite a while, but I stopped. I wrote when I was younger, but I actually stopped for quite a while. And I realized that was something that was missing in my life and in my career. And it just, there was sort of this void that, and once I actually did start writing again, it sort of started filling that void more. And it's really cathartic, getting your thoughts out and also with the intention of helping others as well. And that reward that comes from knowing that somebody benefited from what you know, and that you were brave enough to share that.
Those are great points.
Cool. So let's talk about life-altering experiences and get into your transformation, Victor.
All right.
Every superhero has some sort of life-altering experience that helps guide their purpose and leads to a transformation where they realize the powers they have and harness them for the greater good. And certainly significant among those is failure. Now, failure is not something we like to talk about or put on our LinkedIn page, but it's unquestionably one of life's greatest teachers. Can you tell us a story about what's been the biggest one in your career?
Sure. I love to talk about my failure, Jason. I'm kidding. And yeah, I would preface this with saying, failure is the kind of thing that I think keeps me and a lot of people up at night. Nobody likes to fail. And we do hear frequently that, you know, failure leads to greater things. And I think in a lot of ways that can be true. But man, I'm certainly motivated by not failing as well. That being said, the way you set up the question, I guess, really speaks to what I would call my greatest failure, which did lead to a transformation. And I have been public about it, but my greatest failure, I guess, is both on a personal and on a professional level. And that's my ability to drink in moderation, alcohol. I think that it's very clear to me, not just a correlation, but definitely a causation of the success that I am experiencing currently and my sobriety. So when I first started in working with UX, when I came to Philadelphia and became a full-time user experience researcher, I was struggling with alcohol. And I certainly think back now and realize that I've struggled with alcohol and moderation and overconsumption since the day I met it. And it just masked itself, or it wasn't necessarily problematic. And at the same time, I've spent years thinking I can do better than I am. You know, I do a lot of things. I stay busy. I earn degrees. I transition fields. I feel smart usually, but I don't accomplish all the things that I want to, but I do drink really heavily. And then, you know, everything just sort of came together in the worst kind of way, where you realize you wake up someday and I didn't feel like I was the person that I should have been. I felt like I was potentially this horrible thing called an alcoholic that I had heard my whole life was just terrible, was the worst thing you could be. And that's not who I wanted to be, but I knew I needed help. And I went out and I found groups and I found counseling, and I was able to achieve sobriety. And that was April, I think, so 2014. April 2014, so it's been well over a year at this point, coming up on two. But if you were to track then my writing, my getting a book deal, the money in my bank account, the love I have and the ability to love back with my family members, it's directly this epicenter of April and stopping drinking. And, you know, that really... And I've written about this. I wrote about it for Model View Culture and a piece for Vox.com. It is a failure to me that I wasn't able to moderate my drinking. And I think, like many people who struggle with drinking, you know, I went through probably a year or more of telling myself that I could somehow find this 2 to 3 drink happy place, but never, ever, ever once finding it. But the real problem is that I lost balance of everything else in my life, and I had to have it come crashing down in order to make this transformation. But still, to this day, you know, I don't feel safe, like I could just return to drinking, but I crave it at times. And so it takes, I guess, to stick with this theme of the show, it takes superhero strength on a rainy day sometimes not to pop open a beer, but just as much as it takes superhero strength not to open a beer on a sunny day to enjoy it. And so this failure is a constant failure that I take with me, but I've harnessed it to turn it into a massive amount of success.
Victor, I appreciate you sharing that, man, and your vulnerability and transparency with that, because you're not the only one. And I appreciate you using your writing superpowers to share an experience that is very personal and has certainly been a stumbling block for you. And as you point out, a lot of the events that we attend, there's that element there, and it's in our workplaces often, especially in agency environments and things like that, it's really hard to escape. It does take that superhero strength of willpower of just saying, you know, I know what that does. And for me, I choose not to partake or to participate. So I appreciate you sharing that, man. And again, I know that that many are going to be encouraged by that. I read your article on Vox. It was really great. You go into a lot of detail and about how that transformation occurred in your life. And so I'm going to encourage everyone to check that out. And I do want to also confess for myself, it's not something I've ever really talked about, and my kids don't even know, but I had a real alcohol problem myself, man, real bad, to the point to where I was the first one at the liquor store at 6 a.m. Right. at opening, as you know, couldn't wait for that door to open. And I hadn't slept the night before, to be frank with you. So
I'm hoping that means though that's all behind you too.
Absolutely, it's probably been 20 years plus for me, and it's one of those things where my wife and I, because we both struggled with that temptation, and my wife and I, when we got married in 1999, it was a covenant we both made. Sure, we could have a drink in an event. Sure, we could have a little glass of wine for a toast at a wedding. But you know, we chose to just close that door completely, not even leave it open a little bit. For us, that's worked really well.
Yeah, I think for a lot of people, that's the smartest thing. And you know, for anybody who listens and worries that maybe there's an element of anti-drinking. What I really feel like is that the important piece is for people who want to be sober to have an example of sobriety. So our events can still have alcohol.
Yeah.
But I feel like there should be a piece of the conversation where somebody also says, and hey, it's okay to be sober. So for me, and I wrote about this a little bit on Vox, but the more I've thought about it even since then is this reference point concept of, so when we say we're going to go have drinks at the bar with the client, or we're going to go celebrate something at the bar, you know, everybody seems to be cheering, yay, drink. Yeah. There's not really the guy or the gal raising their hand saying, I'll be there, but I'll be sober. And, you know, I figured I need to be that guy, at least in the situations where my company is involved. So, you know, writing about it, being vocal about it, and saying, I'm going to be the guy sipping seltzer water. Mm-hmm. And I just hope that anybody listening, I don't care if you indulge in alcohol or not, but understanding that the people who are trying to stay away from it or who struggle with it, who might not be attending your events or who are trying to leave as soon as possible because they're not comfortable, one of the easiest things I think you can do to make them feel comfortable is just say, it's fine to be sober at this event. Don't ask people why they're not drinking. Don't make it like somebody needs an excuse to not have an alcoholic beverage. I have a heck of a lot of fun being sober, even at events where there's drinking involved. It's just some people, particularly starting out on the road to sobriety, need a reference point for it's okay to be sober. And there are a lot of people in the room who are sober.
Absolutely. And I'm with you there. This is not a judgment on anyone. It's just certain people have to close the door. That's really it. And I'll tell you, you can easily identify me at any design conference. I'm the guy with the Shirley Temple. I mean, wait, Johnny Temple. It sounds tougher.
Gotcha.
I order a Johnny. Give me a Johnny. Anyway, what's your, this is another one that's sort of an interesting, could be a potentially interesting life-altering experience, and that's user testing. There's some really odd things that can happen sometimes because it's such an awkward environment to begin with. But Victor, do you have any stories of something really crazy or super awkward that happened during user testing? Maybe something with the gorillas?
Well,
or other creatures?
I could tell you something interesting. It wasn't too crazy, but specific to the gorillas, and then I can give you something that I thought was just sort of crazy, like physical comedy can be crazy. But
yes, indeed.
So specific to the gorillas, one time I was actually at a zoo, and I was trying to intercept visitors, just get them to take a quick survey and ask them about their experience, and I saw what I don't know what you call a group of nuns, but I saw a pack of nuns going through the zoo, and I said to myself, I want them to participate in my research. And 2 or 3 hours later, sure enough, they were coming through the gorilla exhibit area where I was intercepting people, and there was a group of four, and I just swooped down on them, and I was like, hello, ladies, I have got the experience for you. And it wasn't. It was, trying to sell people on taking a survey at a zoo. There's active animals is exactly not the best thing to do if you want people to enthusiastically participate. You have to think of creative ways to do it. But, they stopped and did it. And their answers actually really made me think. They made me think of, oftentimes we – one of the things that I was looking at with that research was how do we communicate with people through their values? And I hadn't accounted for religion in a value set of communicating with people. And so while I thought it was almost like a little bit of an inside joke to myself, let me get a bunch of nuns to participate in my research, it actually turned out to be something where I thought, it's not just nuns. A lot of people – religion is a very key to opening their minds or their hearts to being receptive to ideas. And why am I not accounting for some of this? And so, in a way, it was like the joke was on me in that regard. But, whenever you can see a whole group of nuns walking through the zoo, it's just, I don't know, you don't see it a lot, at least in Midwestern America. So that's one interesting story, I guess, from the gorilla testing in front of gorillas. Now, as far as testing in a lab goes, I was with a colleague of mine, and we had a guy walk in to, we were testing a banking application. A lot of the work that I've done is in financial fields. And he sat down in the chair and he was, looked really uncomfortable shifting around. And he like stood up and sat back down again. And he did it one more time. And this, the third time or the second time as he did it, the chair was on wheels and it flew out from behind him as he was going down. And he totally ended up with his legs above his head.
Oh, no.
My colleague and I'm not kidding you. We watched it on the video like three or four times. We did not miss a beat. We continued reading the questions. We acted like somebody falls out of their chair every single time we do a session. And the guy got up and acted like he did that every time that he sat in a chair. So it wasn't until afterwards where we were like, you know, we had to release and we laughed. But looking at it later, it was like we were trained actors who, no matter what you threw at us, we were going to get these questions and this introduction out. You could fall on the floor as long as you were okay. We weren't going to stop what we were doing. We maintained our professional demeanor.
Oh, man, that's great. Good for you guys and having that willpower to just, you know, to restrain yourselves from absolute laughter. Good for
and
you.
And we thought about later, like, you know, if something like that would happen more often, we could put together a whole gag reel of like usability testing bloopers or something.
No kidding. And I thought about that. I was like, that's probably not on YouTube, right? Although it could be.
We don't want anybody's feelings to be public.
Exactly. So you can trust Victor for your user research.
Yes. You fall out of your seat or do anything else absurd in front of me, I'll only make you swear to secrecy on the absurd things that I do as well. It's a two-way deal.
Deal. This episode is brought to you by Universal Mind, a digital design and consulting company based in Denver, Colorado. Whether you started as a digital company or not, we're all digital now, and that's been a tough transition for many organizations. Universal Mind helps mid to enterprise-sized companies find and deliver something valuable through design thinking workshops, UX design, and development consulting, and believes in supporting user defenders to help train and inspire the next generation of designers. Learn more at universalmind.com. Victor, what's your design superpower?
My design superpower. Okay, well, I think that when it comes to design, you know that I come at it from the research perspective, the psychology perspective. So I'd really say getting into the minds of users and making a connection there, understanding what their needs are, and then how I can communicate that to my designers. So, you know, I'm not the one designing the solution. I'm the one who gets the data. I'm the one who builds themes around it. So are there specific areas? And then I work with the designers and the developers to translate that into the solution. So it's really my superpower is understanding their behavior and then trying to create psychological connections that will help influence them to use the design in a better way for themselves and for the designer.
Absolutely. That makes perfect sense. I love that. So adversely, what's your design kryptonite?
I think that interstitials comes to mind, or anything that breaks up a workflow that becomes like illogical to the user. So not having a design that's informed on actual behavior or having gone out and done some testing, I think that, you know, when I say interstitials, I guess, you know, the concept being as you're going through a process as a user, you have a goal, an end state in mind. And when something pops up or transitions you or throws an ad in front of your face that you have to click skip on, that your whole state of mind is transitioned into what the heck is this? And why do I have to think about it when what I wanted to do was pay a bill or make a phone call or do my taxes? So it's really designs that haven't accounted for that. There's a time and a place for all those types of things. And I feel like that oftentimes I encounter, particularly online, designs that really just want to be very up in your face about getting those ads there, getting those opportunities to click and go somewhere else.
Absolutely. And it's a nice segue into something I was thinking about as I was reading your article on A List Apart about persuasion, design, persuasion in design. Persuasion is, as you mentioned so eloquently, certainly has a bad reputation because it evokes a lot of swindling or pressuring to do something you don't want. Mm-hmm. So I thought about this too, and you know, the email pop-ups that come up on blogs and things like that. I really hated that for a long time, but I understand why they're there. I don't hate those as much as I once did, because I totally get why they're there, trying to build an audience, trying to give people the opportunity to be a part of your tribe, and that in group, as you also touch on in your other article. So I totally get that. The thing that really bothers me, however, which I feel like is one of the things that gives persuasion a bad reputation, is those dark patterns that say, hey, you know, like, you want to get rid of the window. Obviously, if you're not interested in signing up, you want to get rid of the window. But it's the language next to the close button is like, no thanks, I want to keep being a stupid idiot because I'm not interested in your yes. list right now. Like, we need to stop this. We need to stop this immediately.
I have a few screenshots of those in my book in one of the chapters where I talk about ways to not be persuasive. And actually, I don't have the reference in front of me right now, but someone has started a complete Tumblr page or something where they're documenting all these. But yeah,
good.
There's and you know what? The unfortunate part is just with a lot of really horrible persuasive clickbait type of things, that there's reputable websites that are using those. Like, I know, well, I guess there's websites that should be reputable. I've seen them on like MSNBC, on Forbes. It's on Car and Driver, where they say these rude things to people like, no thanks, I'll stay ignorant, or no thanks, I'd like to be the last of my friends to know things. Well, that's you know, no thanks, I'll find another website to get my information.
Exactly.
From.
You just insulted me, and you're going to make me feel bad for not just giving you my email address to a stranger immediately. That may not be relevant. So,
exactly.
Absolutely, totally agree with you. So this next one's real fun, Victor. It's what would your design superhero name be?
Well, if I get to create my own superhero name,
you do.
I'm gonna go based on my background and my interests. I'm gonna go with Dr. Persuasion.
Ooh,
does that
That's
work?
That's awesome.
I've always wanted to Love be, it. Just between you and me, I've always wanted to be Dr. Yoctopus, but that doesn't mean anything. Just my last name with Topus at the end, because of, I guess, the evil Dr. Octopus from Spidey. But, you know, a Yoctopus isn't a thing, but it really, I would love to introduce myself as that and then maybe have, like, metallic arms coming out of my side. But I can't do that. So I will be Dr. Persuasion.
And, that's good.
And it's, you know, around the whole... entering the user's mind and understanding their behaviors and their desires and how we get them to do the things that we want in a good way, no dark patterns.
Right, yes. That's great. Dr. Yoctopus starts well, doesn't finish well.
Right.
So one of my favorite lines from Tron was when he said, I fight for the users. How do you fight for your users, Victor?
Well, to be blunt, I show up to work, and that my job is really to fight for the users. And I think that it's not because of who I am. It's because of the awesome benefit of being a user experience researcher, that if I'm doing my job, I'm fighting for the user. I'm in meetings that users aren't invited to and can't attend, but I'm bringing my knowledge of working with them. If it's something where we've done usability testing or interviews, that it's hopefully, you know, I'm bringing in this information of users who have come into direct contact with a product. Otherwise, I'm also bringing my years and years of research experience, my working with users, and my knowledge of background literature in different fields related to creating different experiences. And so when I'm sitting at the table, I'm speaking as Victor, but, you know, my view is informed by users, and I don't ever want to design or influence an experience to have it be just what I would want to do. And so when I make a recommendation, it's based on a coupling together of many ideas that I've gotten from users and from research reports and from industry best practices. So I really feel like it's wonderful to get to do that. And I hope that it comes out as a more usable and useful experience in the end.
Yeah. And absolutely true. Your job, and I love this, your job is to fight for the users. Your job is to know who they are and what they want, what their struggles are. And that is just the perfect way to approach any design project. So that's great. This last question of this segment is, it's a big one, and it's one of my favorites. We all like to think about what the future might be like, and it's hard to believe we're actually living in the Jetsons time when we saw those cartoons when we were kids. You know, it's like, man, that seems so far away, but yeah. We are. But what is, from what you see, from your perspective, what does the future of UX look like to you?
Well, hoverboards that don't explode would be nice.
Yes. No doubt.
Okay. Well, I think for me, taking it from my perspective and my interests, I really feel like the future of UX will include a better tie-in between the information and knowledge that academia generates with practitioners, and whether it's people like me writing about it or whether it's academia acknowledging the need, just like design acknowledges the need to have the user at the table, that academia realizes we need to have more practitioners at the table, and that, you know, if it's a college or a university who is being funded with grant research on psychology or on even cancer prevention, that we can start to bring in designers to the table to help them, to help researchers understand the value of what they're doing, and that then this would translate into quicker and more effective designs. Because another area that I see the future of UX going is just this integration, particularly around health, where the choices people make can be better informed through this immediately available technology. And the real piece that's missing still is something that is easy for people to use to the point where it becomes second nature. As soon as people have to stop to record information or download or upload information, we've put this barrier between just living your life. And a lot of what people are going to do is just habitual. And we need to somehow insert our technologies and our design into the habit rather than even trying to shift the habit. And I think that the future, we will crack that nut, that there are people actively working on it. And whether it's just future iterations of Apple Watches and Fitbits, or it's something that's completely new coming over the horizon, that we'll get to the point where wearables talk to a person in a language that they understand and really do start to make a positive benefit to their lives.
Mm. So many good things in there, Victor. I can't add anything to that.
Did you get that on tape?
I got it on tape, okay. So okay. I'm going to listen to that back a few times. So thankfully we can do that. But I do want to add, you mentioned health in your response, and I think the future of UX for health needs to include not having to fill out 100 pieces of paper every time you go and sit down in a doctor's office. Come on. We can do better than this.
Definitely.
Right?
Definitely.
Please.
Yeah,
somebody disrupt the health industry.
Hey, you know, they talk about it. They talk a big game about digitizing health records and making everything
good Lord
available. But yeah, it's something in part where the commitment needs to be there. The financial commitment needs to be there too.
And yeah, it's just crazy.
I completely agree with you. And what about transferring from one doctor to another and having that all be seamless?
It's like, all faxing. Faxing stuff still.
Exactly.
Come on.
Introducing yourself. Hi, I was referred to you, but you have no idea who I am. And, you know, that all, I completely agree, Jason.
Oh, my Lord.
Needs to be part of the past.
Yeah. Can you tell it's a sensitive topic for me?
I think that anybody with a gaggle of children like you has probably had their fair share of filling out so many forms that, just having experienced childbirth less than a full year ago with my wife and knowing that, you know, sitting at the hospital filling out the entry paperwork that we had already pre-filled out, but hey, why not fill it out again when you get there? You're sort of wondering if by the time you're done filling it out, you'll be discharged with a baby. Like, hey, exactly. You get to the end of the paperwork, we just give you a baby.
Pretty much. Thank you for commiserating with me on that.
No problem.
Hi there, this is Alexa Lee Herasimchuk. I'm a product designer who's curious about why people do what they do. And you're listening to User Defenders Podcast with Jason Ogle.
Okay, let's wrap up the show with the imparting of superpowers.
All right, yes. I don't know how to do that, but let's do it.
What's one habit that you believe contributes to your success?
Ooh. I mean, I guess I'll have to wonder if it's actually a habit, but it's just perseverance, much to myself, I think, becomes a habit. But understanding that the way you get good at something is by doing it over and over again and understanding where you've fallen short. So, for example, you know, I knew I wanted to write a book. My first book proposal was not accepted. My second book proposal was not accepted. But, you know, I kept learning and learning. And so the first time I submitted a book proposal on writing a book about design for the mind, psychology, it was very well received by the publisher. But as I went through the process, they realized it just wasn't going to be the right book for them. They had recently published one that was similar that wasn't very well received, and they thought that mine was too closely aligned with that. And then they had some other feedback, and I didn't say, okay, well, I'm done with this book idea because one publisher thinks, you know, they had a bad experience. I said, I'm taking this feedback, and oh my gosh, it's gold. I'm going to incorporate it into my next iteration of my proposal. And, you know, I think that what you really need to do perseverance-wise is also then save yourself a space to keep learning and growing. And whether it's reading articles online, reading books about what you want to do and where you want to grow. You know, I've read an embarrassingly large number of blogs about how to write a book. I've Googled that exact phrase so many times that I really shouldn't say it in public. But if I ever get, if I'm ever suspected of a crime and they go through my computer, they're gonna be like, the only crime this guy's guilty of is reading way too many blog posts about how to write a book. But, that information is out there. So that's beautiful, right? I Google it and I do get useful information and I read it and my persistence tells me I'm going to keep on reading it and I'm going to keep on trying to learn from it till I crack that code. Mm-hmm. And so that would be, I guess, the advice that I depart on anybody who is in UX or in life in general is that your perseverance will pay off. It really has to. And the thing is you don't know when that's going to happen. So you become impatient on day 20, and it could have been day 21. But at the same time, you could be on day 900 and still have 900 more. But if you want something and you understand that there's a path to get to it and you start working that path, and sobriety is the same way. It looked like a mountain, and it looked like a mountain on day one of sobriety. It looked like a mountain on day 90. Sometimes when I'm walking and I, you know, just the wind blows in the right direction, it still feels like a mountain. But I also understand that tomorrow will be different and the next step will be different. And if I keep on taking those steps, I'm going in the right direction.
Oh, really admire your perseverance, Victor, and sharing that story. It's so easy to sort of take it really personally when people say no to us, when we're trying to get our, especially when we're trying to get our ideas or our creativity out there. It's really it's easy to just say, you know, this may not be for me. But I appreciate your perseverance because you know you have, again, that superpower of really translating your thoughts into words that help people and that really enlighten subjects. So I appreciate you doing that. And I want to just encourage our defenders listening because I know many of you are probably thinking about, hey, I have a book idea. I have a book in me. I think we all do. I think we all have a book in us. And I too, Victor, have done a lot of Googling and I want to two things here. Follow Jeff Goins would be my,
yeah,
he is great. He has got so much great, genuine, authentic advice. He's not trying to, I mean, he's got courses and stuff, but his mission is not to try to cash in. He really likes to help people because he loves to write books so much and great guy. So follow Jeff Goins, but also a brand new podcast because we all love podcasts. Rainmaker FM just came up, or Rainmaker Digital, sorry, that's what they're called now. They just came out with a brand new podcast with Jeff Goins called Zero to Book. And it's nice. Entirely focused on getting your book idea out there. So there you go. That one's for free. So
very good. Thank you for giving us that.
Absolutely.
I would definitely second you on Jeff Goins being a very honest and he shares his experiences and really lessons learned in a way that I admire.
Absolutely. Great writer. He writes a lot of blogs as well, a lot of blog articles that are real helpful. So thanks for affirming that, Victor. What's your most invincible UX resource or tool you can recommend to our listeners?
Well, I think that they all do have their potential Achilles heels or weak spots.
Right.
From my perspective, again, being a researcher, my tools are a little bit different than the typical design tools of like an Adobe Suite product or something like that. But something I do fall back on a regular basis is join.me.
Oh, yeah.
And I would recommend the pro subscription. I believe that actually allows you to do things like sharing mouse control, which so as a researcher and working with clients who have limited budget, instead of trying to visit everybody in person, if I'm wanting to do anything from some usability testing to interviews where I ask people to go through and use a product and explain things to me, I can do that from 1,000 miles away, and I can do 6 people in one day that live in 6 different locations. And
nice.
And again, I think they all have their sort of Achilles heels or areas where they don't necessarily meet what would be the expectation, which is why 50 different versions of the similar product exists. But I found that JoinMe comes the closest in terms of doing remote things, giving you the capability of sharing screen, sharing mouse control, and then also recording and capturing audio and video. So I don't know if they should sponsor this podcast.
So I want to second that, Victor. I've used JoinMe many times, and it is really easy to use, and it's very effective. So I highly recommend that. And yeah, JoinMe, if you are wanting to be a sponsor, reach out to me. So in addition to your outstanding book, I can't wait to read it. I'm saying outstanding because I just know it's going to be. It's called Design for the Mind. In addition to that book, that you and Manning Publications are generously offering a 39% discount code for our listeners. That's right, isn't it?
Yes, that's exactly
39%.
Right.
Wow. So in addition to that, and I'll be sure to link to that, if you could recommend one book to our listeners, what would it be and why?
That's a hard one. One book, maybe one bookshelf full of books. You know, I think I would say it's going to be not that original, but Don't Make Me Think by Steve Krug.
Oh,
And my logic behind that is, whether you like it, love it, or don't, is that it's a mainstream book that comes out of UX. You know, it's a bestseller. It's sold a couple 100,000 copies as far as I know. And there's a reason for that. It's not because it just happened. It's because Steve really gets into the mind for a designer of what your user is thinking. And it's really simple. Don't make me think.
Yeah.
And then he shows you with great screenshots and annotations where designs make people think and what it looks like to not make people think.
Right.
And that's what you should be striving for. So it's really, you know, if you have somebody who's entering the field and you want to give them an understanding without making them go out and interview a bunch of people, I would say that you start them out with that book and say, this is going to show you the mindset of your average user, and you need to keep this in mind as you're creating your designs.
Absolutely. It's funny. You are either the second or third guest that has recommended that book. It's a testament to like you said, the reason it exists. This is probably the second or third time I've said I haven't read the book all the way through, but I have it. It's probably one of the originals because the binding is totally falling apart. I have to like hold the pages together. But anyway,
too long because there's actually a revised edition that recently came out with more recent examples and things like that.
I wonder if that was by design, if Krug said, hey, you know what, if they don't read it within a decade, we have a self-destruct mode to make them buy it.
All books might have that. If you don't read me within a decade, I magically evaporate off your bookshelf.
There you go. I read most of my books on my tablet now, ironically, but there really is no substitute for actually holding something in your hand, holding a book. I agree to that.
Well, I'm excited that Design for the Mind will be coming out both in ebook and paper copy. So
awesome.
It's due out sometime in March, possibly get pushed, but currently is available. The complete manuscript is available for early access, which just means, to my sometimes dismay, that the not fully copy edited version can be accessed. So you'd get the full manuscript at this point, and you can use the discount code now. And if you bought the paper version, you would get the ebooks all come with that, and they would just ship you the hard copy when that actually comes out, but you'd have instant access to it. And really, I don't know if all the files are available that have been on there, but it's been a really interesting adventure in how the book itself has even changed shape from version 1 to what is now on the website that you can access is version 6. Is like, yeah, if you had version 1 and version 6, you almost have two books because of how different it shifted. And in my mind, the quality and the content shifted some, but the quality didn't. And so you really have just like two books at that point. And there's, I think maybe I started off a little more technical than I should have in terms of version 1, but the content there is still useful and usable.
No, I love that idea. And that I didn't even consider that you could actually have two books by the time everything's done with the editing process. And I do like the idea of actually including the audience into that process. It's like, hey, if you want to get an early look and start learning early, and it's a way to kind of crowdsource the editing process. I think it's a great idea.
Yeah, and I'm not sure that like any fiction publishers are doing that at this point, but really I think it's something that's very special to design, and it really shows like our field's ability to take criticism and take feedback and also want to meet the needs of our users to say, hey, you know what? I'm going to expose this not professionally edited document for you to give me feedback, because ultimately in the end, I want to present you with the book you needed.
Absolutely. And it's kind of going to that social identity theory that you wrote, that great article, and the in-group. You're kind of creating your in-group too. That's the second time I've used that term today, by the way, Victor. Thank you. I actually used it in an email earlier before this interview to talk about a test we did, a gorilla test. So thank you.
Excellent. Well, I'm glad I could help in any way that I can.
Indeed. So, great article. I'll link to it. Social identity theory.
Perfect. Yeah. So Smashing Magazine article.
Yep.
It's one of my, I think it's my first one that I wrote for them, which soon coming out will be my sixth, which is all about how to do user intercepts, in which I talk about doing gorilla research in front of gorillas. So
can't wait for that one. Absolutely. I'll be sure to share that on when I see it on the Twitters.
Cool.
So this is the last question really I have for you, and then we'll do a closing stuff. This last question, I think this is also one of my favorites, the future and this one, because this is all about, you know, giving back. Honestly, for me, and doing this stuff for over a decade, or 15 years actually, I came to this place where I realized I was kind of like the Dead Sea. You know, if you are religious at all, the Dead Sea has water coming in, but it has no outlet. So it just, all the water just sits there, stagnates, and it's smelly. And anyway, not to get too descriptive, but it's just sort of like this quagmire. And anyway, I started feeling like, how can I not be the Dead Sea and actually give back and let that have an outlet? So all that to say, that long story short, this is my question for you, is what's your best advice for aspiring design superheroes?
Ooh. Huh. Well, I'm going to say, for all you aspiring design superheroes out there, it's really getting the most experience with understanding people. Ultimately, you're designing a product that you want people to use. Even if it's a product for an animal, you're going to have a person who is somehow responsible for making that product work with the animal. And so the more your background consists of the ability to empathize, to understand a situation, to think about the user in their natural habitat, mm-hmm. the better you'll be, the more clear it will become that if you have a decent set of design skills, what will put you up over the top and really make you stick out above your peers will be your ability to identify what human needs are and how to address them. And the way you do that is by getting to know, understand people, put yourself out there, be social, and then bring that background to your work.
Awesome. So good, man. Victor, as we close, can you tell us about one thing you're working on that you're most excited about? I think you touched on it a little bit, but there might be something else.
Well, I think something that I'm excited both personally and professionally is that I've managed to line up some speaking opportunities around the issues of alcohol and design. And so I'm excited that this year Design for the Mind will come out, and maybe as I transition into making sure that I don't have any free time in my life at all still, that I can start picking up and running with my message around, it's not just a message around sobriety, but it's really a message around inclusion. And that's to say, we work in an industry where we focus really heavily on lubricating our events, even our workplaces, with the availability of alcohol. I don't want to criticize that to the point where people feel like I'm a teetotaler. What I want to say is I believe that if we are going to go out of our way to make alcohol available and promote its use, then we have the equal responsibility and obligation of making sure that our workplaces and our events are safe and receptive to people who are choosing to abstain from drinking. And it's very simple. There aren't a lot of hard things about that. And I feel like I have insight into that and can really make good recommendations. It can be as simple as saying, just as the same time you're saying, let's all go party and drink. And if you're not drinking, come party too. That, you just created a more inclusive environment.
Yeah.
And don't ever ask anybody why they're not drinking.
That's good. That's good. So as we close, why don't you tell our audience the best way to connect and keep up with you?
Sure. So you can follow me on Twitter. It's at Victor Yocco. That's VicTorYocco. You can connect with me on LinkedIn. You can call me on my phone, but I will never answer. I very rarely answer, so phone number is not even worth it. And you can even shoot me an email at my full name together, which is VicTorYocco@gmail.com. And I try to be responsive. So those are probably the three best ways. I try to tweet. Mostly what I do is just share articles and sometimes give a little snippet of a comment. Try to keep it relevant to either design or alcohol related issues. LinkedIn, you can find out what I'm doing work wise. And then email. Always love a personal message and you'll get a personal response.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Victor. Really, really enjoyed our conversation today. It was a delight to have you. I appreciate you taking the time. I'm sorry I went a little over with you. There's just so much good stuff coming out here, but it's been a great pleasure with you. And I just want to say, fight on, my friend.
No problem, Jason. Thank you. I think you're doing a great service for the industry.
Thank you so much. Wow, right? I had so much fun talking with Victor. He's got so much insight and expertise in psychology, human behavior, and research, which is sort of the holy trinity of fighting for the users. As mentioned in the interview, Victor is the author of the soon-to-be-released Manning Publications book, Design for the Mind. He and Manning Publications have generously offered an exclusive Defenders discount of 39% off with no expiration. Victor told me it's slated to be released sometime this April of 2016, but as we know, with book publishing, that could change. Be sure to keep tabs for its release and that valuable coupon code by visiting userdefenders.com/017 or follow me on Twitter at @userdefenders for the announcement. Because I know you fight for the users, I encourage you to subscribe to the bi-weekly Bugle at userdefenders.com/join to find out who the next super guest is and get my usable thoughts. I want to thank Cesar Limas for the astonishing superhero artwork, Chris Combs for the superhuman editing, and Wyman Gentry for the compelling show music. Thanks again so much for listening, and until next time, fight on, my friends.